DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum on DW, your one-stop shop for all the latest in science and technology. I'm Zulfikar Abani, and coming up...
So, are we ready to land on Mars or what?
They did indeed, and we've got the lowdown from Darmstadt, where European space scientists were also on the edge of their seats. Also on the programme, FAD, or medical sports must-have, Kinesio tape, and knock yourself out with a round of chess boxing, right here on Spectrum. NASA's Mars rover Curiosity touched down successfully on Mars after surviving a complicated landing, dubbed the 7 Minutes of Terror. After more than 8 months and 350 million miles travelling through space, the rover landed, as expected, at Gale Crater and will now spend one Mars year searching for evidence of life. Holly Cooper was at the European Space Agency's control centre at Darmstadt to follow the landing and saw the first images coming in.
At 7:31 European time, NASA's Mars Science Laboratory, also known as Curiosity, successfully landed on the red planet. Shouts of exuberance erupted simultaneously from the NASA live feed and from the European Space Agency, ESA's, Operations Center, where scientists and researchers had gathered to witness the event that could have gone horribly wrong. At NASA's request, ESA's Mars Express was in position to observe the landing. Mars Express has remained in orbit of Mars since December 2003, when its Beagle 2 lander failed to make communication. It's controlled by ESA, here at Darmstadt. Paolo Ferri heads ESA's planetary mission operations.
I can say from what the little role of Mars Express to see this data, it took us months to prepare for these few minutes. I certainly can share the happiness and the pride of these people.
The landing is known as the 7 Minutes of Terror because ground control had to endure a 14-minute delay in radio communication before it knew whether the landing had been a success. Mark McCochran is ESA's head of research and science support.
You know, lots of money and lots of time has been spent trying to do as much testing as possible, but in the end it came down to those minutes, those 7 minutes.
The delay was fully expected, but meant that Curiosity had already been on the surface for 7 minutes, when NASA was only just receiving information that the landing capsule had entered the atmosphere of Mars. But then, it wasn't long before Curiosity had relayed its first thumbnail photo via NASA's Odyssey satellite, the first of many. The high-definition photo shows the back of Curiosity, wheels down, and Mars' horizon in the background. A second image showed the opposite direction, with Curiosity's shadow against the surface. Curiosity is NASA's most challenging planetary science mission to date. It's packed with laboratory equipment and will spend the next 686 days, that's one Mars year, searching for signs of previous life on the red planet. Mark McCochran again.
We can all play gambling games. Was I 50% sure it would work? Was I 80%? It doesn't matter. There was always the chance that it wouldn't work. And we know Mars has eaten up lots of spacecraft in the past with even lower technology systems. And it worked. And I think we should be really proud of what they've done at NASA to put that system together and excited about what comes next, which is doing the science for everybody.
During the two-Earth-year mission, Curiosity will explore Gale Crater to determine whether the atmosphere on Mars was ever suitable for life, or still is, even if only at a microbial level. Using data from Mars orbiters, scientists believe the surface of Mars has been shaped by flowing water. The geology of Gale Crater also suggests traces of water in its erosion patterns. Thomas Reiter is ESA's director for human spaceflight and operations.
For me personally, it's just a question of time when we find the evidence for life. It's hopefully now with Curiosity, but we cannot be sure.
Mars has two polar ice caps composed of frozen CO2 and frozen water. There are also indications of liquid water, with images from NASA's Phoenix lander having revealed what appear to be droplets. McCochran says Curiosity's work at Gale Crater will be different from that of other rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, which have operated elsewhere on Mars.
They've gone into a very exciting place with a lot of different geology in a very small area. In the past, Spirit and Opportunity have been to locations where there's more or less one thing going on, and they had two rovers, two different locations. Gale has a lot going on in one location.
Scientists want to analyze isotopes and minerals on Mars to learn how the planet's atmosphere has developed over the past 4 billion years.
We're certainly going to be, you know, sitting on the edges of our seats waiting for the pictures, and we've seen the first couple of pictures come back already this morning. But when the science starts, when the big main camera deploys, the first panoramas, I think this is going to be something quite special.
Curiosity is not due to move for another week, but Manfred Varhaut, head of ESA's Mission Operations Department, says the information it will eventually provide will bring the international space community closer together.
I hope, and I think I can also speak here in the name of the European Space Agency, that this successful landing gives NASA a boost up to rejoin international cooperation with our ExoMars program, and this is what I'm looking forward to.
Costing $2.5 billion, or 2.1 billion euros, and that over budget, there's a good chance NASA will want to get its money's worth from Curiosity first, before it shares the spoils. This is Holly Cooper for DW in Darmstadt.
And don't forget you can keep up with Curiosity over the coming weeks and months via dw.de/science.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
It's just gone a year since a group of Austrian students started its campaign to take on Facebook over its privacy policies. Known as Europe versus Facebook, the group alleges that the social networking giant is breaking European law by holding on to information that users have deleted. With Facebook's European operation based in Ireland, they've had to work through the Irish Data Protection Commission. Now, they say they've effectively been shut out of the process. Kerry Scarry reports from Vienna.
I'm meeting Max Schrems, the spokesman for Europe versus Facebook in Café Ritter. He's so well known here, mainly through meeting journalists like me, that his coffee is ready before he sits down. As we settle in, he reads his latest email from the Irish Data Protection Commission.
Dear Mr. Schrems, we have repeatedly and considerably indicated that this office has nothing further to add to what we have already stated in previous replies on procedural matters, and therefore I do not consider that any useful purpose will be served by yet again discussing the same issues.
A year ago, Europe versus Facebook launched a complaint with the Irish authorities, alleging Facebook was breaking European privacy laws. They lodged 22 complaints, and the commission began to investigate. It led to some changes at Facebook. But Max Schrems says the company is still outside the law, and now he's been told by the only authority he can complain to that they won't even talk to his group.
The problem is that we were not allowed to see any of the evidence, we're not allowed to even know the counter-arguments from Facebook, we're not allowed to see any of the files of the proceeding, which makes it really hard to have a discussion before that board, because if you don't even know what the other party is claiming, you have a really hard possibility to figure something out, especially because the Irish should, according to the law, work for an amicable resolution, which is not going to work if you don't even know what the other party is claiming and what they're doing.
This month, for example, Timeline might show everything that I've done.
Facebook's founder, Mark Zuckerberg, has found hundreds of millions of takers for his vision of social networking. And the group, Europe versus Facebook, is itself quick to point out it's not anti-Facebook or social networking. It just wants the US giant to obey European laws. But all of those Facebook facilities that users enjoy are paid for by advertising. And Markus Deutsch, who heads the Advertising Industry Association at the Austrian Chamber of Commerce, cautions against data protection laws which would harm his industry.
The dream of every advertiser in the advertising industry is to find the right consumer. In the old, so-called old offline world, it was very, very difficult to identify the right consumer. In the online world, it helps a lot. But also the consumer profits a lot when he gets information about the best price, the best quality internet, and so on.
But where to find the balance between privacy and transparency? Europe versus Facebook alleges the US-based giant is not open about what it does with the data it collects. And if European companies are obliged to obey European privacy laws, why not Facebook? Markus Deutsch agrees there needs to be a level playing field.
Especially those with the American spirit-driven huge multinational companies, I think they are not on the same level playing field as Austrian and European companies. They don't have to be in accordance with European or national privacy law, and this is a huge business advantage.
So where are we now in the Europe versus Facebook saga? The Irish authorities, who are not giving interviews, say they are auditing Facebook's compliance with EU laws and will decide in October whether the company should face legal action. But Max Schrem says that because the Irish Data Protection Commission refuses to talk to him, he doubts its ability to conduct a fair process.
The background problem is that the Irish Data Protection Commission has about 20 people, and none of them has a legal background. None of them is legally trained. So on the one side, there's us. We have a very fair idea of what's in the law. And we also have our lawyers. And on the other side, there is Facebook with a ton of lawyers.
This small group of Austrian students says there are two main issues at stake: the right to have your postings on Facebook deleted from all records when you hit delete, and the need for compliance with the law. They're getting some political support. Earlier this year, the European Justice Commissioner Viviane Reding announced new EU data privacy rules.
With this reform, the European Union will create a real single digital market, accessible both for companies and for consumers.
But, says Max Schrems, Facebook continues to snub European privacy law. And with Facebook based in Ireland and the Irish economy in need of foreign investment, he fears he may lose this David and Goliath struggle.
It was very hard to find lawyers in Ireland in general, because either the tech lawyers either worked for Facebook or want to work for Facebook, so not a big interest to represent us. And plus, we were told that we need at least €100,000 in order to be able to fight that through, which is, of course, way too much for a couple of students.
Max Schrems and his student supporters are preparing for a long, drawn-out battle.
Kerry Skyring reporting there from Vienna. And you know, there's another interesting little factoid about Facebook that's cropped up in the past week. In a company report in the past week, Facebook said there may be as many as 83 million false accounts on its website. Apparently some could be duplicates, but others could be for pets. Well. Moving on, we've also had the feeling this past week, that some of you wanted a little more detail on my quip about data network issues at the Olympic Games, which I made last week. Well, just to recap, a couple of days into the Games, it seemed that spectators were being asked to avoid all so-called non-essential texts and tweets because the huge demand for data was apparently interfering with TV coverage of the event. Well, far from wanting to editorialise, I have to say we did find this somewhat interesting, coming from the first Games of the fully-fledged digital age. We've since discovered that the organisers' request that people reduce their data usage had either been taken out of context or made before all the facts were in. But still, when I spoke to Stuart Newstead, an independent tech consultant and chair of the Olympics Mobile Experience Group, I had to ask him first whether the Games organisers had underestimated the demand for data.
No, I think there's been an awful lot of preparation here. The way we've gone about it, trying to understand the demand, is we've looked at lots and lots of different events around the world, each of which has given us some insight into what's going on. Obviously, there's nothing like the Olympics, and the London Olympics is nothing like the Beijing Olympics in terms of the extent of smartphones, tablets, and particularly video, the use of video on devices, which is what takes a great deal more capacity. So, for example, we've looked at the Super Bowl in America. We've looked at the UEFA Champions League final, which was at Wembley. We've looked at rugby internationals. We looked at the Royal Wedding. We looked at the Jubilee. So we looked at lots of different events, and that's given a great deal of insight to reinforce the modelling and the thinking that has been done by each of the mobile operators, by the likes of the BBC, and has then helped inform the planning that has gone on, which then has led to a great deal of investment and a great deal of collaboration between the networks in order to make sure that the capacity available in the Olympic Park, then across London, and then across the UK is as good as it can be.
As good as it can be, but it can't be denied that there are some problems. I mean, the organisers have said there are problems. So where exactly are the issues? What are the causes for the problems? Because we've heard that, you know, for instance, TV coverage has been disrupted.
TV coverage is different from mobile.
No, I know, but one of the comments that has been made is that people should avoid non-essential texts and tweets because it's been interfering with TV coverage. So clearly,
what you're saying now. Yeah, I think that would be a response that was made before all the facts were known, because there was an issue on the cycling road race on Saturday. but that was primarily around the specific devices that were being used, which hadn't been as configured as well as had been expected.
So going back to what was said before the game started, before this comment about non-essential texts and tweets.
The comment about non-essential is not, it's, that's not the way it is.
No.
The experience since then, you'll see that people have been having been able to tweet, been able to send photos, been able to send videos, and it's just not an issue.
Good. Well, I mean, you would expect that to be the case, because this is a games in the 21st century. I mean, this is what it's all about. People are communicating.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Via these methods. So you are now saying that there's absolutely no issues with the data networks.
What I'm saying is that the way the experience has been working since the games have started has been consistent with what we expected and is as good as it practically can be. It's a bit like saying, like any athlete, you prepare as much as you possibly can, and then the gun goes, the race starts, and then you something might happen, but all being well, the race will go according to plan. And currently, the race or the mobile experience is going according to the planning that was done.
So can you give us an idea of how much data people are demanding?
Yeah, it's rather like having 4 royal weddings a day for 17 days.
Right.
And
that means?
That means that we have waves of spectators coming in and out. So, for example, when people then, say, want to share a short video clip, that's probably the equivalent of about 500,000 text messages going at the same time. So it just gives you a sense of the difference that goes on between what might have happened, say, 4 years ago in Beijing when people were texting each other, compared with now when people are sharing far more social media and far more video around that social media.
The providers have also installed quite a lot of hardware, haven't they, in preparation for the games? And it also seems that they've devised a fairly expensive voucher system for data, of Wi-Fi vouchers, as they're called, I think. Can you give us a bit of an insight into that? What's going on there? I mean, is this a chance for the providers to earn as much as they can?
No, it's clear that obviously it costs money to put the service in place. It's a commercial service. It's being charged at the standard commercial rate.
But why have MiFi devices been banned? What's the issue there?
When you have Wi-Fi in the past, and that great concentration of people, BT obviously is taking the lead in being the main communication provider on the Olympic Park. Therefore, it's naturally very concerned about any technical interference that might happen with devices, which in essence create their own Wi-Fi hotspots. So they're concerned about any interference with other people.
Stuart Newstead, chair of the Olympics Mobile Experience Group, on the line there from Oxford. You're listening to Spectrum with me, Zulfikar Abani, on DW. Online, we're at dw.de/spectrum, and you can, of course, follow us at dw_SciTech. Well, staying with the Olympics now, you may have noticed a new quasi-health trend popping up, albeit based on a very old idea. It looks like a plain old stripe, colourful but plain nonetheless, and it's everywhere at London 2012. It's called Kinesio Tape, an adhesive tape that comes in all kinds of colours and is used by athletes the world over to provide muscle and joint support, it's said. It was discovered in Japan more than 30 years ago, but this year it's become the must-have performance enhancer. Plenty of non-professionals wear Kinesio too. But some scientists are now saying that it's little more than a fashion statement and that it has no health benefits at all, other than to boost the psychology of the player. Jesse Wingard has been looking into it.
The stretchy adhesive cotton strip in fluoro pinks, blues, yellows, and even the Union Jack won't be found at nightclubs or being worn to dinner. This novelty is being sported around the London Olympic Games. The founder of the Kinesio trend, Dr. Kenzo Kasa, says the adhesive tape is designed to provide muscle and joint support without restricting an athlete's movement.
My taping method tries to lift the skin and we can allow the normal circulation and reduce the inflammation, and also we can resolve the problem of the pain.
Judging from the number of athletes wearing the tape, it must work. But that hasn't stopped some scientists questioning the efficiency of the Kinesio tape. John Brewer, a professor of sports science at Britain's University of Bedfordshire.
If you look at some of the claims that are made, particularly those that suggest that it lifts the skin to improve blood flow and to improve the flow of the lymph system, I really can't see any way in which that actually happens. If you think of basic physics, in order for something to lift a surface, there has to be an opposite reaction. And there is no way that sticking a tape on the skin can actually create an opposite reaction. or an opposite force that will lift the tape upwards.
But Harry Pineppel, a Netherlands-based instructor in applying the tape, says those who are sceptical about kinesio have yet to catch up with the athletic community.
So when we give an impulse and stretch or pull the skin, there will be coming reactions in the body. That way we try to influence body-owned healing processes.
Kinesio can be seen on the limbs of countless athletes, gymnasts, platform divers and tennis players. Even Novak Djokovic has been seen sporting the stripe, all apparently believing in its powers of injury aversion and treatment. So too Jochen Vollmert, Germany's table tennis hopeful at the Paralympic Games 2012.
As far as I'm aware, there's no real research into whether it helps, but it seems, at least to me, that it does help. Of course, it's not that it has a healing effect, it only reduces the pain. It doesn't heal injuries.
Kenzo Kasa developed the tape more than 30 years ago. He says he believes in its healing powers, but acknowledges there is no scientific evidence to support his claim.
Athletes, especially Olympic, very high level of athletes, want to do perfect performance. And to be able to do a perfect performance, they want to be a comfort. And actually, my tape can make comfort.
Dutch kinesio practitioner Harry Pineppel says the tape targets particular zones in the skin.
So we have zones in our skin, and by trigger the zones, you can have influence on processes of organs in the body.
But Brewer says the effects of the tape don't go deep enough.
Many of the muscle groups that are involved in producing powerful physical movements rest deep beneath the skin. They're close to the bone, they have tendons and ligaments that join them to muscle and to bone. But they're a long way from the surface of the skin. So again, as a scientist, I really fail to see what mechanism will result in them improving performance or preventing injury with a tape that is just simply stuck on the surface of the skin.
Brewer even goes so far as to suggest that kinesio's success in treating sports ailments is a case of mind over matter in the fullest sense.
My own view is that the benefit is more of a placebo effect, that it actually gives the athlete the feeling that they've almost prepared for their sport. It's a little bit like the sort of war paint that you find cricketers putting over their eyebrows, the sunscreen and so on, to get them in that mood, to get them in that psyche to take part in sport.
Either way, if it works, it works.
Jesse Wingard reporting there. Now, Berlin has just hosted the latest chess boxing championships, you might have heard, and you're right, it should really be an oxymoron, but it could be the best way to find out who is the smartest, toughest guy in the world. The man behind it is Dutch performance artist Eppe Rubin. He grew up playing chess and started boxing in his 20s, then read a graphic novel by the French-Serbian author Enki Bilal, who envisioned chess boxing in its entirety. And by 2003, chess boxing was born for real. Players fight 11 rounds in the boxing ring, alternating between 4-minute-long rounds of chess and then 3-minute-long rounds of boxing with a minute break in between. And a player can, of course, win with a knockout or checkmate. But our reporter, Cinnamon Nippert, has been wondering whether all the knocks to the head can mess with a chess player's game. She headed to the Platoon Kunsthalle in Berlin to find out.
Chess boxing is a test of the body and the mind, possibly the mind more than the body. The head gets hit with fists and hit with the harsh concentration required in a top-level game of chess. Some of the best boxers in the world have come away from their careers with brain damage, and they're probably not playing chess in their retirement. But chess boxing founder Eppe Rubin says that this sport is an expression of manhood in the 21st century.
Fighting is done in the ring and war is waged on the board. Which means, like, you fight in the ring, you don't fight in a bar or in the streets. And you wage war on the chessboard and not in the Middle East. It's all about the control of aggression.
That's all well and good, but it does seem a little bit brutal seeing two guys beat each other up. I suddenly realise I've never seen a real boxing fight before, and judging by some of the winces from other audience members, it's their first time too. The first match is between 24-year-old chess grandmaster Arik Brown, who's studying physics and maths, and 40-year-old IT developer Felix Bartels. Brown started chess boxing 2 years ago, while Bartels began just 4 months ago.
Actually, a guy I play poker with, he taught me that he's doing chess boxing, and
It seemed to be quite interesting, so I went to the boxing. And it's what I really like is the people in the box, because they are, I think they are different than usual boxers. Like on the first day in the locker room, there were two guys exchanging book titles, which you probably won't see in a normal boxing club. And so I like the idea of being able to fight guys without having this really hatred against each other. So, and the training is really good.
The match between Brown and Bartels goes for the full 11 rounds, and you can see it really taking its toll on both players. In the end, Brown wins on the chessboard in the final round, but he looks worn out and will soon be sporting a black eye.
And do you worry that getting hit in the head is going to make your chess game suffer?
No, I think, it doesn't take for long, the headaches or whatever. I think it's not making it worse.
None of the guys seem particularly worried about the effect of punches to the head. While doctors remain divided over whether Muhammad Ali's condition is caused by boxing or Parkinson's, Dr. Ingo Schmell, director of the Clinic for Neurology with Stroke Unit and Early Rehabilitation at the Emergency Hospital Berlin, has seen more than his fair share of head injuries caused by boxing and other sports.
Die Geschwindigkeit, wenn ein Boxschlag auftritt.
The speed of a punch in boxing is 10 meters per second. That's what hits the head. And you can see in this MRI brain scan, these little dark spots indicate bleeding in the brain, typically after a head injury or even after a knockout.
Holger Prokot is a Berlin-based physiotherapist and the chess boxing ring referee. He started boxing at age 10, later became a coach and then a ref. And he also trained Ipa Rubing. The second two chess boxing fights end abruptly with knockouts in the first round of boxing. Prokot says that's a risk of boxing beginners and has a few words of caution.
I've never understood how grown-up men decide to take the risk of going inside the ring, for it's really dangerous, you must say. They are not 10 years old and weighing 30 kilograms. They are big men, 6 feet tall and weighing 80 kilograms and more. And there's lots of energy, and mistakes inside the ring are punished very, very hard.
But despite the pummeling, the guys seem to love it. Seeing 24-year-old Niels Becker shout with victory, his pure male muscle. And it's a little funny to think that he's also studying renewable energies. Becker says it's really hard switching between chess and boxing and keeping calm on the chessboard.
It's about to find the balance between the fighting sport and the mental sport. So it doesn't matter if you're a good chess player or a good boxer, you have to combine both of them.
Dr. Ingo Schmell warns that blows to the head can cause many problems, from concussion to dementia. They can also cause short-term memory loss, affect fine motor control, and slow down cognitive ability, which means you can't react to situations so quickly.
After a hit in chess boxing, you can see how things slow. So, with the chess, which demands intense concentration, players might react slower or even lose.
While chess boxing seems to be the thinking man's fight club, the boxing part just isn't so good for your grey matter in the long term. But if you still want to jump in the ring, the doc suggests investing in some protective headgear. Cinnamon Nippard, DW, Berlin.
Well, that's just about all from Spectrum on DW for now. Don't forget, you can always keep up with our stuff at dw.de/science. Listen again or download the podcast at dw.de/Spectrum. Of course, there is also the Twitter, DW_SciTech. I'm Zulfi Karabani. Our studio tech was Claudia Rack. Coming up soon on Spectrum, cracking the monsoon code in India. Hope you can make it for that. Till then, thanks for listening and bye for now.
We could have had something so good, but you broke it.